Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be looking back at two local authors who achieved international acclaim in 2014. We'll hear from Joseph Boyden, whose novel, The Orenda, was the winner of the Canada Reads competition in March of 2014. We'll also hear from Nii Osundari, whom we interviewed in 2011, on the publication of City Without People, the Katrina Poems. Nii Osundari received the National Order of Merit from his native Nigeria in 2014. Novelist Joseph Boyden is one of my favorite New Orleans writers. Author of Born with a Tooth, 3 Day Road, which won the Amazon Canada First Book Award along with many others. Through Black Spruce, which won the prestigious Scotiabank Giller Prize, again with many other honors. And now his most recent, The Orenda. The Orenda was a selection after a heated debate for the Canada Reads Program. Joseph's on the faculty of the University of British Columbia and the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, and he's a graduate and former faculty member of the University of New Orleans Creative Writing Program. He lives both here and in Northern Ontario, and if that doesn't make you wonder how you get it all done, I don't know what will. Joseph, I am so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
It's great to see you again, Susan.
Now, The Orenda is such a moving and beautiful book. And it's a book with a poetic and mysterious title. Tell us what that means.
The Orenda is, it's an Iroquoian word and also a Huron word. It basically means the soul or the life force in a being. Very similar in some ways to the Christian idea of a soul, except that the Iroquois and the Huron believed, and still do to this day, that not just humans have a soul or an orenda, but everything does. A body of water has its own orenda, mm-hmm. tree, a rock strewn on the ground even has its own orenda, its own life force, its own spirit. And so this is kind of the spiritual view of the world for what in Canada we call the First Nations people.
And I think it's something that's going to appeal to a lot of New Orleanians, too.
I think a lot
of people have that feeling about
absolutely.
This place, these things. This is the book that you have said you were destined to write, the story of a Jesuit missionary named Christophe, a Huron leader named Bird. That's a name we've heard before in your fiction.
Yeah.
And a young captive girl called Snowfalls, adopted by Bird into his own family. And through these three, you've traced some of the most important events in Canadian history.
It's North American history, really. It spans the border between New York and Ontario, what is present-day New York and Ontario. This novel takes place in the mid-1600s, so I go way back in history to kind of some of the birth stories of our continent in terms of the Western perspective.
And what was that like for you? Because some of this has that feel of mythology and folklore and the kind of ancient poetry that comes with those forms.
Well, it was amazing in some ways because it's very freeing to be able to go back to a time period before there was a United States, before there was a Canada, when there were many, many nations already, not just surviving on this continent, but existing in amazing and complex ways. These were cultures, North America was covered in cultures that were as complex as any culture in the world at the time. So it was really fascinating for me to go back into these very specific ones of the Iroquois, or they call themselves the Haudenosaunee people, and the Huron people who called themselves the Wendat people, and looking at these two societies, and then the intruder, the outsider, the European coming in to kind of throw this very fine balance off. And, Christophe the Jesuit doesn't come with bad intent in his heart, but he certainly messes things up upon his arrival mm-hmm. in all kinds of ways.
Now, this is a very violent history as well, and you've taken some hits for writing some very violent scenes in this book.
Yeah, this is a time of war. The Europeans came over, the French came over and made alliances with the Huron. The Dutch and the English came over and made alliances with the Iroquois, and old rivalries between the Iroquois and the Huron really heated up, and suddenly there's a war of attrition going on very quickly. And, it's also the first arms race in North America with the introduction of the rifle, of the musket.
The Shining Wood.
And so, this it is a violent novel. And I've taken a few hits, but, my wife Amanda, who you know, she drives her crazy. She's like, there's more violence in one episode of Game of Thrones than in your whole novel.
I know. It's so
like, why
true.
Are people like, I guess I did my job, you know. Mm-hmm. The Iroquois and the Huron did the practice of torture amongst one another. And it wasn't an everyday occurrence, but when it did happen, it was a very tough thing. But, you know, there's only maybe 20 pages of torture in this novel, but it does seem to be something that a lot of people have kind of focused upon. I think it's that threat of violence during a time of war. There's always that mm-hmm. constant threat of looming violence that kind of permeates much of this novel. And I think that has its effect on the reader.
And war has always been such an important part of your writing. War of all different sorts, cultures, yeah. you know, as well as nations. Yeah. And when you go back this far, I think you're going back to a time when war was face-to-face.
Absolutely. Yeah, this was a very personal type of warfare that existed at the time. And, you know, the idea of torture was the hardest thing for me to wrap my head around in terms of writing this novel, this idea of why would one group of people torture each other. It was actually an honoring thing, you know. Keep in mind, too, during this time period, the mid-1600s, the Spanish Inquisition was going on full tilt. And so this idea of torture of other humans was this kind of world pandemic, you know, this epidemic going on, I feel. And so it's kind of fascinating for me to look at the very two different reasons between cultures for torture. With the West, with the Jesuits, with the Catholic Church at the time, torture was a way to demean and belittle and to punish and to mm-hmm. say, you know, you are wrong. With the Iroquois and the Huron, it was very much the opposite. It was to honor and to say, we respect deeply who you are and we want to take that power from you for ourselves, kind of thing. So it was a very, very different approach to this idea of the treatment of humans.
And a lot of this is about what made these villages work.
Yeah.
You know, there's ritual. They're really powerful women who instruct each other in
absolutely.
The ways. And,
yeah.
you know, and then they're the war bearers. And
yeah.
it's all these complicated roles. And I wonder if you talk a little bit about my favorite character, who is, of course, Gosling.
Yeah, Gosling is she's an Ojibwe and Anishinaabe woman who has been taken in by the Huron people. My mother's maiden name is actually Gosling.
Oh,
my family, I'm a mixed blood family. I'm a family mm-hmm. of Irish, Scottish, and Ojibwe roots. And so I really wanted to pay homage to my mother's side of things with Gosling. And she's a medicine woman who is, you know, a little bit mystical for sure, who has great power of seeing a little bit into the future and of being the one who warns, you know, be careful with this crow. They called the Jesuits crows. Be careful mm-hmm. taking this crow into your community because at first he might just seem harmless and funny and yeah. entertainment, but there's something very mysterious about him that can cause us great harm. You know, this is a time period in the mid-1600s where the Huron people, probably a population of about 35,000, and around the southern shores of what's called Georgian Bay today, a beautiful part of Ontario. But within 10 years of the first Jesuits arriving, the population was slaughtered down to 10,000 through disease, yeah, that the Jesuits brought unwittingly into these communities. And just there was no defense for it in these, you know, that's 3 in 4 people. Think about it. You have a
yeah.
family of 4, suddenly you're left alone kind of thing. And so this was a sadly part of the real history of the time period. So, you know, this goes back to the idea of violence, too. It's an unwitting violence, but it's violence nonetheless.
Mm-hmm. What I loved about Gosling, though, I have to say, is it's just that notion that even then there were women who lived lives on their own terms.
Oh, absolutely.
Completely.
Well, these are matriarchal societies, the Iroquois and the Huron, where the woman was the power broker. The woman was the head of the community. The men never really felt themselves and manly until they were off in the forest going off on mm-hmm. trading expeditions or hunting expeditions, but while at home, the women were the ones you listened to. And I have seven older sisters, and so I know exactly that feeling. You know.
Pay your respects. Now, this is not only an historical novel and a political novel, but it is really a prolonged spiritual meditation. What did writing that do for you? I mean, I can imagine reading this book, what it took out of you
yeah.
to write it. But what did it give you?
Well, I've said in the past, this book is kind of a part of my DNA. I was, you know, being from a family where we lived in the city, we lived in Toronto growing up, and I went to a Jesuit high school, was mm-hmm. educated by Jesuits. And I always saw that one side. The Jesuits came to the New World, and, you know, the heathens were around the fire waiting for civilization to save them kind of storyline. And I always heard that side of the story, but then I'd look at my other side of my roots and I'd be like, we're not savages. These are incredibly complex societies. So I really wanted to capture the idea that these communities, these cultures that were already here before the Europeans came, were incredibly complex. We're living in fine balance with one another. Didn't just live, but lived very well. You know, the Iroquois and the Huron were agrarians. They were great farmers and they were rich, you know, in terms of all kinds of things, in terms of culture, in terms of food supply, in terms of religion. And with the Europeans coming, it really threw that balance off.
Now, one of the things that fascinated me was, and I don't think I've ever read this anywhere else, is that you really write about the cost of conversion.
Yeah.
What it meant to these people to give up a native religion.
Yeah. Well, you know, Orenda, I think, cuts to the heart of what I was trying to get at. This idea, you know, Christoph shows up and he's like, what is this Orenda thing they're talking about?
Yeah.
And they explain to him, well, yeah, we have a soul. And he's like, great. You know, this is my jumping off point with you. I have a soul too. I believe in the same thing. And then they go on to say, well, but this dog walking by, he has his own soul too. And that's where Christoph, the Jesuit, goes, no, wait a second. That's Satan's talk now. This is not right. And so this kind of clash of very different views of the world makes for good fiction, I think, you know. Mm-hmm. I could write about, you know, a nice, gentle, boring day where there's no war or anything else, but that doesn't necessarily make for great fiction. You know?
Where's the fun in that?
Yeah, where's the fun in that? Yeah.
Now, whenever a writer finishes a book, I mean, and this has taken you years. This is the book of your heart in so many ways. You know, you sort of go out into the world and you offer it up with varying degrees of success. And you have had that success in Canada and you have had some controversy as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. This is the first time, you know, I've had it pretty lucky with my novels to date. You know, Three Day Row and Three Black Spruce are very well accepted in North America and in Europe. And Native people, especially across North America, really love those books. But this is the first time with the Orenda where I've got a little bit of slack from certain professors and in the Native community, certain academics saying, this is just an excuse for colonialism. And I was just gobsmacked when I started here. And it was only a very small number. There was two or three people, but these were the only negative reviews coming out of Canada and in a sea of really strong and positive reviews. But I was really kind of hurt in a way because I felt almost like I was jumped upon by a couple of people because they didn't like what they saw as the message in this novel. That was clearly not, for me, the message I was trying to send out into the world.
And not the one I received.
Most people don't,
yeah,
you know. But controversy is good for certain people to get names out into the world. You know, and I listened and I spoke to all of the people who, and again, there was only a handful, but it was a bit stinging. You know, the Iroquois people are known as great warriors and they're the bad guys in this novel. And so there are some Iroquois people who said, you know, you're just painting us again as the bad guy. And I was like, no, Snowfall's is Iroquois. She's a Haudenosaunee and she's my strongest character, I believe. You know, where there's a bad guy, there's a good guy. Where there's a good guy, there's a bad guy. When you make alliances, you're going to make enemies. And so this is a novel where the Iroquois are represented as being the great warriors, but they also created the great law of peace. And this is something that I hope permeates through this novel as well. This is a novel, of course, about a time of war, but it's about family and about healing and about going on after you've lost everything. How do you go on? Whether you're Iroquois or Huron or European or, you know, so.
And about enduring friendship as
absolutely,
well.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So now we're the last to get it here in the United States.
Gary Fiskejohn purposely waited. I'm glad. It's like we kind of stretched things out, you know, came out in Canada in September and then the United Kingdom in November and then France in the spring and then the United States now as well in the spring and other countries to follow. But Gary Fiskejohn, if you're into literature, you'll know he's this incredible editor. You know, he's Cormac McCarthy's editor. He's so many other amazing writers' editor. But he only does about 10 books a year. And when I got the call that he wanted to personally edit the Orenda, I was over the moon because he's a powerhouse, you know?
Yes, he is.
Yeah.
So did you do most of the writing here or did you?
I did, yeah. I wrote so much of the Orenda either at home in Mid-City or at the Fairgrinds coffee shop there by the racetrack. Every morning I was going for months and months at a time and wrote a lot of the story here in New Orleans for sure.
What does living in New Orleans give you? I would think if you were home in Canada, you walk down the street and everybody would know you.
It's getting kind of weird up there. It's funny because this Canada Reads thing, the Orenda won it and it's kind of jettisoned this book into like...
And we should say, for people who don't know, that was a very public debate about what book would change a nation.
What book can change a nation, yeah. And it's five Canadian celebrities each choose a book and they go at it. And I don't know if one book can change a nation, you know, but It was a great honor to have this book win that competition. So.
It was great. I loved seeing all those debates on YouTube.
Yeah,
it was fascinating.
Yeah, really well-spoken people and interesting debates.
We've been talking with Canadian novelist Joseph Boyden, who makes his home in New Orleans part of the time.
Most of the time.
Whose unforgettable new book is The Arenda. It should be at the top of your must-read list. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
The publication of a new poetry collection by Niyi Osundari is cause for rejoicing, not only here in New Orleans, where Niyi teaches at the University of New Orleans, but also in his native Nigeria, where he is one of that country's most celebrated and distinguished writers. It's a pleasure to celebrate the publication of Random Blues with him today. Welcome back to The Reading Life, Niyi.
Thank you very much, Susan. It's a great pleasure to be here again.
Now, this is a book. It was published in Nigeria, but it was inspired by a classroom experience here in 2006. How did that cross-cultural transaction come about?
Oh, you got it right. Real transcultural transaction. I was teaching African-American literature to a group of very enthusiastic students in the English department. And the particular section we were dealing with is the Harlem Renaissance. And, of course, Langston Hughes towers eminently above others in that period. So I got one student to read one or two poems by Langston Hughes, and he read a blues poem. As he was reading, you know, the repetition, then the tone and so on, somehow it just occurred to me, I think I have heard this song before. Of course, I have been reading Langston Hughes for years, but I don't know what happened that moment that I had that sense of, almost a frightening sense of deja vu. The class ended, and from the classroom to my office, the Liberal Arts Building, the poem was on my mind, and I kept on trying to remember where I heard it. When I got back to my office, I picked up my copy of the Norton Anthology of African-American Poetry. And I don't know, it was so coincidental, reached out for one of the poems of Mitchell Cliff, which is written in the blues mode, and I read it. Somehow I knew I had heard these songs before. That was December 2006. So when I got back to Nigeria, because I usually go to Nigeria twice on research tours, I went to the village, went around, and then my mother reminded me of a song my father used to sing. Ebi pa mi o manu kan jejo. Awe, ebi pa mi o manu kan jejo. Kejo je ara ni noni kime ba atishe. 6 lines. You repeat the first 2 lines. Then you have 4 lines. Then there is a line between that is like a diaphragm. And then the last line. The only difference is that in the English version, you have the A, B, C, B, pattern, rhyme pattern. In Yoruba, there is no rhyme pattern of that sort. It is systemic rhythmicality that you have. And that was it. So my eyes opened and I started writing blues poems, trying to capture the African situation, the Nigerian situation in it. And this is how it really began. It is really transcultural. And I call it Enilo Lobo. That is a Yoruba name. Enilo Lobo means the person who left is the one that has returned. The blues left with African Americans when they were taken away as slaves across the Atlantic went through so many years, centuries of gestation here. At the beginning of the 20th century, it was born. But it was born here, very American. Now, here am I, a 21st century American Nigerian, taking this back to where it actually began. But, of course, it's such an experience.
Mm-hmm. When you were writing these poems, did you sing them? They're so musical and lovely.
Yes, I was humming them to myself. Yes, a blues. That's the New Orleans, Mississippi blues that, you know, that I've been hearing all along. In Yoruba land, there is a rhythm that is very, very similar to that. But the drum is very, very much in the center. Here, it's the guitar. So I was humming it to myself. Basically, what I do when I write poetry, I have always believed that poetry and music are first cousins. Or if not Siamese twins, Siamese twins. One cannot do without the other. I like the discipline this set of poems has imposed on me in a way. I hardly ever rhyme in my other poems, but this one I have to rhyme. And so many times the sounding of the word brings in so many other poetic facilities that I would otherwise not have thought about.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you'd read one for us. This is one I especially like. It's Random Blues number 42.
Okay. A well-honed shaft circumcises the manhood of the sun. Yes, a well-honed shaft circumcises the manhood of the sun. Rainbow blood on mountain tops, dripping clouds on the run. My story lies before you like an open book. See, my story lies before you like an open book, every chapter fresh and green like a bamboo clump beside the brook. Hit the drum when the skin is taut. Hey, hit the drum when the skin is taut. Sometimes hard of hearing, history fades to a mere hum. Mold my clay while it's soft. I say mold my clay while it's soft. The hammertan is on its way. Shape me clean without delay. The river crosses the road without stubbing a toe. I say the river crosses the road without stubbing a toe. Two long friends forever hungry, sometimes laughing at their common foe. There is a little boat on the lake of your heart. Yes, baby, a little boat on the lake of your heart. Let us row, let us ride on every wave forever afloat. Gather life's rainbow in the pit of your palm. I say, gather life's rainbow in the pit of your palm. Read the lines in a hail of hues. Tell tomorrow to be quick and calm.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Oh.
Thank you.
One of the miraculous things about these poems to me is that they appear every Sunday in the newspaper, in Nigeria's Sunday Tribune. Mm. That seems amazing given what's happening with American newspapers.
Yes, of course, there used to be a time when we had poetry and poems, actually, in many American newspapers. What happened with the Tribune, really, was 1983. That was a period of this very despotic military dictatorship in Nigeria, and the soldiers were trying to keep everybody silent. I took to poetry because of the indirectness of the expression and so on. It was experimental to begin with, but people reacted very well to it. And since then, I've been trying to do it. It's very challenging doing a poem every Sunday, but I have adjusted to it, and I think my readers do expect it.
I'm sure they do. And many of these poems are overtly political. Mm. They are not all personal blues. It's the blues applied to everything in life, isn't it?
This is what I call my own extension of the blues idiom. Yes. Over here, it's, oh, my lover, she's gone away. Oh, what am I going to do? Oh, the sun is going down on me. And so on. Yeah, there are emotional blues that way. In Africa, our problems are really great. The political edge is important, and the audience actually asks for it. So there is political blues. What I have done, actually, is to create a meeting point between satire and the blues.
Well, it's just a reminder that the blues is such a fluid and important form. Mm. You know, and works for everything. It's just an amazing book. Mm. Neo Sundari's new book is called Random Blues. It's been a pleasure, as always.
Thank you very much, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Start the Adventure in Reading offers the last in this round of training for literacy volunteers, Tuesday, January 20th at 1:30 at St. Augustine's Episcopal Church in Metairie. To register, contact the STARE office at 504-899-0820 or email elizabeth@starenola.org. Lee Farrow signs Alexis in America, a Russian Grand Duke's tour, 1871 to 1872. Tuesday, January 20th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Great Books Discussion Group talks about A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens. Tuesday, January 20th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Andrea Watkins signs Not Without My Father, One Woman's 444-Mile Walk of the Natchez Trace. Wednesday, January 21st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Ralph Adamo, Jonathan Klein, and Andy Young present An Evening with Dialogos and Lavender Ink Books, Wednesday, January 21st at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Mickey Pfeffer discusses and signs Southern Ladies and Suffragists, Julia Ward Howe and Women's Rights at the 1884 New Orleans World's Fair, Wednesday, January 21st at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Historian Christina Vella discusses the pleasures and perils of steamboat racing, Thursday, January 22nd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Louisiana Cultural Vistas, the magazine of the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, celebrates its 100th issue with a party Thursday, January 22nd from 5 to 7 at the Louisiana Humanities Center, 938 Lafayette. Congratulations to this great publication. The Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Writers Group meets Thursday, January 22nd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Nancy Dixon signs N.O. Lit, 200 Years of New Orleans Literature, Friday, January 23rd at 6 at the Women's Center for Healing and Transformation in Abita Springs. And coming up this weekend, the Historic New Orleans Collection's 20th Annual Williams Research Center Symposium takes as its theme, Forgotten Conflicts, Indians, Andrew Jackson, and the War of 1812 in the South. The event begins Friday evening and is followed by an all-day symposium Saturday. For information and to register, check out hnoc.org. Gary Stewart signs The Most Dangerous Animal of All, Searching for My Father and Finding the Zodiac Killer, Saturday, January 24th at 1 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Arthur Hardy will sign his new book, Mardi Gras in New Orleans, and the new Mardi Gras Guide 2015, Saturday, January 24th from 2 to 4 at Tubby & Coo's Mid-City Bookshop. Dr. Leong Ying signs From Newton to Einstein to God, Saturday, January 25th at 1 at Garden District Bookshop. Poet Paris Hughes reads from her work, followed by an open mic, Sunday, January 25th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Dan Gutman signs Genius Files No. 5, License to Thrill, Tuesday, January 27th at 4:30 at Octavia Books. Brian Boyle signs New Orleans Boom and Blackout, 100 Days in America's Coolest Hotspot, Tuesday, January 27th from 6 to 8 at Handsome Willie's, 218 South Robertson. Novelist Barry Gifford signs The Updown, Tuesday, January 27th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.